Give me a mic check for Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, hello, check one Tampa, check two Tampa. I need some more on one.
Okay.
Casino, check, check. Hard Rock, Tampa, check, check. Seminole Hard Rock.
Check it out for yourself at SeminoleHardRock.com. All right, guys, I'm rolling. Let's kick it.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations podcast time in Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today, I'm joined by Mike Leonard, lead singer and one of two guitarists in the Minneapolis-based band The Bleeding Hearts. When they recorded their 1993 album Riches to Rags, their lineup also included the late Bob Stinson, formerly of The Replacements, as their second guitarist. Their debut album didn't finally see its release until this past Record Store Day, and the title track is a recent coolest song in the world. We'll hear some of that now, followed by my interview with Mike on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Looking for a ride down Easy Street. On a coattail, take me off my feet. I didn't have a dime, but I knew how to have a good time. And I called you, but you were still.
It's Coolest Conversations time here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and I've got Minneapolis-based musician Mike Leonard on the line with me today. Back in 1993, he got Bob Stinson of The Replacements to join his band, The Bleeding Hearts. And with Bob, they recorded the Riches to Rags album. By the time the sessions were completed, though, Bob was out of the band. And though the group continued on for a while, the album was shelved until now. Some 27 years later, it's finally seen the light of day with a Record Store Day release on April 23rd. Mike, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I am hanging in there. I'm hoping that, did you manage to keep healthy over the past couple of years?
Fortunately, been working from home and just kind of been in quarantine for, seems like forever now. Yeah.
So with the last few months, have you managed to get out a bit more or come into contact with people again, or how's it going?
It's funny. I went to a show last week, went to go see Brian Jonestown Massacre, and Mercury Rev was supposed to be on the bill as well, and they ended up canceling due to COVID problems. But it was cool to get out, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned working from home. What is it that you do for work?
I work for Best Buy. Best Buy corporate.
That's cool. You don't have to be out there on the floor, you know?
Right. No, it's an office job.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, I've read, and we'll talk about how Bob wound up joining the Bleeding Hearts and how you guys are regulars at the Uptown Bar. But first, I'd like to know some more about you. Like, where are you from originally?
I'm from Minneapolis or St. Louis Park in Edina. I grew up there. And so I lived in Minnesota my whole life.
Well, I've heard how you are or were fixated on the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I guess at this point, I might be their biggest critic as well as the fan.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah, But yeah, I started when I was probably like 9 or 10. I went through a Elvis Presley phase, like when I was 6, 7 years old. And then Kiss. I was a big Kiss fan. That was my first concert when I was 10. And then after that, it was like pretty much delved into the Stones pretty hard.
Well, what's cool about that is you go from sort of Elvis to Kiss to the Stones. How did Kiss get ahead of the and get in front of the queue in front of the Stones, I wonder.
Yeah, it was just kind of some friends in the neighborhood that just turned me on to Kiss, and we used to do like the little, put on our own little Kiss concerts in the basement. And Kiss was a pretty straight ahead rock and roll band for the first 3-4 records. So, it kind of wasn't that big of a jump, and it was just kind of like the whole, I think they appealed to a lot of 8-year-olds.
When you say you put on Kiss concerts in the basement, what do you mean? You were playing records and dancing around to it, or dressing up and miming the group?
At that point, it was just air guitars and just cranking it up on the stereo.
Well, you're a guitar player, right? When did you start playing guitar?
I started probably when I was 10, 11. Somewhere around there. I remember I kind of haranguing my parents into letting me get a guitar, and I wanted to get an electric guitar. And we went to the guitar store, and they said, "Well, we recommend he starts on acoustic guitar." So I kind of had to work my way up to electric. So that took a couple years.
Oh, so yeah, they did make you take play an acoustic guitar first then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, in the long run, was that, do you think that was good? Did that
it probably was. I still question the logic, though. I mean, I was like probably 11 or 12, whatever. And why do you start on acoustic? Electric guitar's got a smaller neck. Would have been easier to play an electric guitar, but yeah, it's always good to kind of get the foundation, I guess, with some, learn the country chords and a little rudimentary, finger picking or whatever. And none of that stuff hurts when you're, later on when you're playing Chuck Berry or whatever, right?
Right. And your folks then, they sound like they were fairly supportive of you embarking on your musician career, right? Or not?
I wouldn't go that far. I'm actually a preacher kid. So my dad was a Methodist minister. And so there was a little consternation that, I would like, when I wanted a Kiss record or something, they would have to like approve, if the record cover, we don't like the way they look on this cover, so I think the first Kiss record I got was Destroyer. So I don't know. That somehow passed the girl test.
Well, it's funny you say Methodist, because I'm from Atlanta originally, and the joke there from this Southern writer Louis Grizzard was there were two kinds of religion in the South. There were the Methodists and the Baptists, and that was it. And generally, you'd want to be aligned with the Methodists because they at least seem to have fun.
Yeah. Yeah, in a lot of ways it was pretty relaxed, compared to other denominations. Or
were you raised with any siblings? Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I had a older brother, 7-year old. My brother is 7 years older than me, and then a younger sister. So I kind of inherited a lot of records from my older brother when he went off to college, which was
good. Yeah, well, so what was it that you were inheriting from him? Because I'm interested that you were kind of keyed into Elvis when you were pretty young. Was that records from your older brother or your parents or?
Yeah, no, that so that was just me. There was this show that came on television called The Roots of Rock and Roll. It was probably around, I don't know, 75 or so. And it had all this great archival footage of, you know, and so I, right then I started, you know, trying to save up and buy Elvis records. I kind of bought a couple of random ones. I mean, I didn't have like the cool, you know, like the Sun Sessions or anything. I had like Elvis Live in Las Vegas. I think it was like this, maybe might have been this 1970 concert or something. It opens up with like a Hound Dog medley, or, you know, it's kind of not the coolest. But as it turns out, though, my mom had actually seen Elvis in concert in 59, and she's from Dallas, Texas, and so she saw him. Yeah, she was an Elvis fan, so it wasn't hard to get them on board with Elvis. But then later on, when it was the Rolling Stones, it was like they couldn't stand the Rolling Stones.
So you go through the Elvis phase and the Kiss phase, and then you're get a little older and you're playing guitar. And these, so how old were you when you played in your first band?
Oh, well, probably, honestly, 14 ish, I'd say. Eighth grade, ninth grade. And by band, it was mainly just three guys in a basement. We didn't really get too organized, but a lot of jamming, you know, all through junior high and high school. And then first band that like played out was probably, God, it was after high school, like probably 89 ish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was that in the group called?
That group was actually called the Midwest Pop Experience, which I didn't come up with that name. But yeah, that we played a new band night at 7th Street Entry.
Oh, 7th Street Entry. Yeah, I know that that cinder blocked area very well. You know, it's like going in there and you know, it can be cold there in Minneapolis. You know that. Well, for a guy from the South, it's just brutal, you know? But even like when it was tempered outside, we'd get in there and it's like, man, this is just these cinder block walls and down in this weird green room or backstage area, sort of this basement. It was just, man, that was kind of soul crushing, you know? but they would let us play, you know, and we had some good shows there. So the Midwest, did you say it was Midwest Pop Experience? Was that the group?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So when you were playing with that, were you writing any songs for that?
Co-writing. That group had a lead singer and, but I was coming up with like song ideas on guitar. So, I mean, you know, like, God, that I want to say that group probably only lasted for me for like probably that one show. And then it was kind of on to, you know, starting the Bleeding Hearts from there.
Oh, well, great. So, when did that initial lineup for the Bleeding Hearts get together?
Somewhere around beginning of like 1990.
And so initially it's three guys, right? You and the bass player and the drummer.
Well, we always wanted it to be a two guitar band. And it was kind of a revolving door of second guitar players. You know, we'd find someone that we thought was going to work and then either they'd quit or something would happen. And, One guy, it was a friend of ours from high school. He was a great guitar player. His car started on fire driving home from a gig, and his amp and guitar were destroyed in this car fire. So that was his exit from the
Oh man. Well, he at least got out of the car unscathed, right? I mean, he
right.
Yeah, wow. That's so you're looking for another guitarist, and guys are coming and going, and you know, nobody spontaneously explodes, but there's some car fires. And how does Bob come into the picture? Because it seems like you had reached out to him, but initially he didn't want to join you guys, or what's the story there?
Right. By this time I had, started running into him at the Uptown Bar and stuff. And, it was after the car fire incident that I had the idea that, you know, I should get Bob Stinson to play. He was reluctant initially. We brought him down to the practice space, one afternoon, and he kind of was dragging his feet a little, and he kept saying, you know, you should get this guy Jamie from the Leatherwoods to play. And we're like, no, Bob, you know, we want you to play. And he kind of kept saying this over and over, and he was he had been having a few drinks beforehand and was a little sloppy, and we were playing super loud. It was just like noise, you know. And after about 45 minutes, you know, we were like, okay, all right, Bob, who is this guy? You know, and he took us, we went straight from the practice space to the Uptown Bar to go have Bob introduce us to this guy, Jamie, who would actually end up joining the band.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Who was this guy? His name?
His name was Jamie Garner. He was a guitar player in a band called the Leatherwoods.
Uh-huh.
Great band. Great guitar player. And he played with us for about, I don't know, 9 months or so. And then he ended up moving to San Diego, which is when Bob then kind of stepped into the fold. I think he had seen us play a couple times with Jamie, and at that point he wanted to play with us, so that's where.
And how did he go? So he wants to join the band, and you're cool with that because you guys initially had been hoping he would, and somehow he's also kind of moves in with you, sleeping on your couch, sort of a roommate. What's this?
It's funny. He came over. It was middle of winter. He walks all the way down Lake Street to my apartment. We sat down and went through all the songs. He learned all the songs in like 45 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Really quick. And then I think he may have suggested then, you know, I should move in here. You know? And I was like, oh, all right. Yeah, so he did. I helped him move his stuff out of his mom's basement. I think the next weekend, and yeah, he occupied that couch for the next year or so, for good or bad.
I don't know if I've read this. It was sort of, it seems like there was something. I saw some story about him. So taking your records and selling them at a record store, and then later on feeling kind of guilty about that and trying to buy the records back.
Yeah, that's something like that. In fact, I recently got a new stereo and got all my old records out, and I'm still, to this day, I'll kind of see a random record and I'll be like, where did this come from? So it was like he had no idea which records he took. In some cases, like he would buy, you know, he might remember what artist it was, but it would be a completely different record, or it would just be a completely random artist. Like I have no idea, you know. It's kind of funny. It's like, You know, it's like, where did this Bachman Turner Overdrive record come from?
Well, it was just a gift in a roundabout way, I suppose. He's ready to broaden your musical reference there, your horizons. Right. Yeah.
Yep.
So he joins the band and he learns these songs pretty quickly and he's moving in with you. When did you actually record the album?
Let's see. Well, we did the album in two sessions. The first session was in March of 93. And Bob was still living at my place in March. And then I think he moved out somewhere between March and August, which was the second session.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the upside of Bob staying at my place was, you know, obviously before cell phones and stuff, if, you know, he was easy to track down, you know, it was like, hey, Bob, we got to go to the studio. Let's go, you know, try to make sure he's in the right state of mind and everything. But that second session, you know, I remember we were scrambling around trying to find him and knocking on doors, and I think we eventually did, but it was a little stressful, you know, kind of.
When he moved out of your place, where did he go back to his mom's, or where was he at?
No, he was staying at some other guy's. I think he was on someone else's couch at that point.
Yeah.
It's funny back then, you know, the landlines are, you know, trying to find somebody who's kind of couch surfing could be a challenge.
Right. So you mentioned Bob learning these tracks or songs that you guys are doing in about 45 minutes. When you go on to record the album, by that time he knew what his parts were. I mean, he had been involved in any of the song arrangements.
He knew his parts after that first, you know, evening. Like it was like boom, 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 boom. You know, when he was focused, he could just, you know, it was a really quick study, and he would kind of put his own little spin on things too. You know, like even if I had like a guitar, you know, riff or a melody that I wanted him to play, he'd learn it and he'd play it, but he would, you know, kind of put his own little stamp on it. You know, and of course this was about a year, we went into the studio about a year after that, so I mean we'd been playing together for at least a year, I think. So there were some there were some newer songs and in there as well, that he, you know, he contributed ideas to, and, you know.
And working with him, like talking about ideas, is he somebody that was coming up with lots of ideas, too many ideas? Did you have to pull stuff out of him?
No, I mean, it was funny because he would come up with like bass lines, you know, or drum parts, you know. We'd practice like probably twice a week. We'd go down to the practice space and you know, I think the band got pretty tight. But yeah, it was always funny to me how he'd kind of have like a random idea and he'd kind of get behind the drums, and even though he can't really play drums, he'd be like, you know, you gotta play this at the end, and all of those ideas would somehow wind up in the song. You know, it'd be like, cool. Okay.
Well, our coolest song in the world this week is the title track, "Riches to Rags." When did you write that tune?
That was a song I wrote after Bob had joined, and in fact, that was one where, Bob kind of came up with that bass line for it, which was cool. It was probably written in late 92.
And these songs you were playing out at the time, right? They'd been sort of
right?
Tempered with live shows. So got to find another tune on there. Got to Find a Way is a fave of mine, and I tend to think there's a bit more Who to that one than Rolling Stones. What's the story on Got to Find a Way?
It's interesting. That one I wrote before Bob had joined. It's funny. To be honest, that song to me kind of had, it sort of echoes a little bit of Soul Asylum too. In fact, I saw Dave Perner at a party one time, and I said, I wrote a song that, you know, sounds like one of your songs. and he kind of goes, oh, well, we'll record it and give you the royalties. But
oh yeah, well, I guess that hadn't happened yet.
Yeah, that didn't happen, but yeah. it, you know, here we are, 28 years later.
So Happy Yet, we're talking about Bob and couch surfing. So Happy Yet has got the lyrics about sleeping on somebody's couch and the line, I'm as happy as I'm going to get. Is that tune directly about Bob?
Well, to be honest, yes. But it's funny, that song, it was like a newer song we were working on, that was the only song on the record where we were in the studio and didn't have lyrics, and it was, you know, it was time to record the vocals, and I told everyone to, you know, give me a minute, and I quickly wrote those in the studio. So I think they definitely reflected what was kind of happening at that time.
Yeah. Well, that is one that Stephen wants to add into, he'll add after the Riches to Rags has got its week as the coolest song. Now, who is it that is playing harmonica on What Do You Want?
That actually is me.
Well, cool. When did you play harmonica still or often or?
I'm actually looking at a harmonica right now. I mean, I don't play it often, but yeah. I mean, I've always you know enjoyed harmonica, I guess. You know, the main thing is once you figure out how to like bend a note on the harmonica, then you're pretty much good to go, right?
Well, I agree because I do play in my own bands, play a harmonica, and that people think I know how to play, but really it's like, no, I have no idea, but I can, if I can get it cross harp and get in the right key, then I can kind of do a riff here or there. And you're right. If I'm bending those notes or wailing on a couple of notes, you know, that carries over for a couple of beats and people seem to think, you know what you're doing, you know?
You're right. Yeah. When we did that, we, that was a late, you know, decision to add harmonica to that. Cause I think we had hoped there'd be a little bit more, guitar interplay with Bob on that one, and mm-hmm. and there was a lot of space on that song, and I was overdubbing some guitar solos. Bob did the guitar solo at the very very end.
Yeah.
But then we decided, you know, we could play harmonica, and you know, we ran the harmonica through an amp, you know, and got that cool harmonica tone, and I remember Tommy the engineer commenting that it sounded like a real harmonica player.
Yeah. Well, it does. I agree. Tommy was right.
Yeah.
So I guess the typical script is boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, and for you guys it was, you know, band wants Bob, band gets Bob, band loses Bob, but there's no getting back. Why did Bob leave?
Well, you know, he had a lot of personal issues, you know, he was dealing with. You know, it turns out that after he moved out of my place, he was actually diagnosed as having a bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
And they were actually beginning to treat that. So, you know, unfortunately, a lot of that, you know, stuff could have been, you know, improved upon. But, you know, while he was living with me and throughout, you know, the rest of his life, he, you know, he had his demons and you know, he had a lot of sorrow and pain in his life too. So,
yeah.
You know, I was just a, you know, 22-year-old kid. I just wanted to play rock and roll. And I, you know, I wasn't qualified to, to be, you know, kind of a life coach for right. someone. But I mean, yeah, so we butted heads, many times, you know, while he was living with me, gotten a few fisticuffs and here and there, you know, and things like that. But one time it's kind of, some of them were kind of funny though. I mean, a lot of them were actually, but, one time we got into a fight and we ended up in the kitchen. We both simultaneously punched each other in the jaw. Like it was like, you know, have you ever seen a boxing match where two fighters actually knock each other out at the same time? It was like that, but we didn't knock each other out, but we both connected on each other's jaws. And Bob says right after, that deserves a hug.
Oh, man.
So we just went from punching each other in the face to hugging in 2 seconds. It was
wow. Yeah. You see, at in your core, you were lovers, not fighters, you know.
Right. Yep.
So this guy, Bob Mayer, wrote the liner notes to the album, To Riches to Rags. He's also the guy that wrote that Replacements biography, Trouble Boys. How did you get him involved with the album, to write the liner notes?
Well, I met Bob while he was writing Trouble Boys, and we've remained, friends ever since. He's been kind enough to share some of those, copy of the book, and I've gotten a few of the Replacements records and stuff that he's had a hand in producing over the years here. So it was just kind of a natural idea to see if he would be willing to write something for the record, which he very generously did. It's like another, it's almost a book unto itself, what he wrote for the liner notes.
Well, you know, I wasn't able to get a copy of that. All I've got is a reference to a line that he writes, that Riches to Rags is the final piece to the puzzle of Bob Stinson's musical career. And recognizing it is a piece, do you think it's right? Does that, being with the Bleeding Heart sort of completes the puzzle of his career, or are there still pieces missing?
No, I think that is accurate. I think that was the last session he did. So that was spring and summer of 93. And then, he passed away in 95. Pretty sure that was the last piece. He had some other records with Static Taxi.
Mm-hmm.
That was before this, before the, you know, Bleeding Heart. Yeah. So it is the final piece.
So you are currently in the Magnolias, and you started playing with them shortly after the Bleeding Hearts had ended.
Right. I mean, the Bleeding Hearts hadn't officially ended, but I joined spur of the moment, I guess you could say, because I was with them in Chicago, and their guitar player bailed on them, and they had a couple more dates on a tour, and I ended up being kind of the Johnny on the spot there.
Hmm. And so you, so you're the lead guitarist in the Magnolias?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually John Freeman from the Magnolias is the, well, he's playing rhythm guitar in the Bleeding Hearts now as well. So,
okay. So the Bleeding Hearts are ongoing still.
Well, we've kind of got dusted off the cupboards there and got them going again.
About 6 months. Well, you know, it's pretty appropriate. There's like this album that just came out.
Right. We want to keep our options open here. So
sure.
We got.
Well, I was wondering with the Magnolias, like you, with the Bleeding Hearts, you guys have this great. This great album was just come out, but the songs are great. Did you, on these intervening years between 93 and now, did these songs ever get played in any other groups? Did the Magnolias, did they ever do any of these tunes that you would come up with?
Once in a while. Yeah. I mean, okay. With the Magnolias would play like Poker Face, occasionally. I think we've done Happy Yet before too. So yeah, I mean, for the most part though, I mean, a lot of this stuff has just kind of been almost forgotten about. I mean, we're playing them all now and it's been kind of fun to revisit them, but a lot of those songs we hadn't touched in a long time, 20 plus years.
Well, so I was going to ask you, and I will still, what the Magnolias have got coming up, but since you mentioned the Bleeding Hearts, you know, playing stuff, I mean, with the album out now, do you have any plans to do any shows or to tour even?
We do have a show on Record Store Day. We're playing at the Eagles Club in Minneapolis. We have one show. The Magnolias are kind of in the process of trying to get another tour going in Spain, hopefully this year or next. You know, whether that anything could be like parlayed with the Bleeding Hearts and the Magnolias, or you know, basically, you know, we're up for anything. So
well, you got to tell those Spanish promoters it's 2-for-1.
Right.
Now, so let me ask you this, Mike. It's like my favorite thing about playing shows in Spain. I mean, the crowds are great. You know, everybody's always energetic and it's always amazing. Like you're playing some small town, but they've got some real music fans and they're like singing the words to your songs. It's like, this is incredible. And that's all great, but I have to say, it's like the food is what is really the greatest thing. It's like, okay, we've done the show. Let's eat, you know?
Right. That's funny. Yeah, I when we were in Madrid, this was back in 2009, one of the promoters took us out for tapas, and I was the only one that had the guts to eat the blood. It was some kind of blood sauce or blood pudding or something.
Yeah.
It actually wasn't bad, but I mean, literally like, everyone else at the table was just refused, you know?
Oh, right. Like, oh. Yeah. Well, there was one time we were in Japan and our host, she had made this cow tongue. She'd cook the cow tongue and she had other things too. And you would take, and when she was shopping, she said, oh, you know, if you think they will eat cow tongue? And I was like, absolutely not, but just don't tell them that's what it is. Just tell them it's beef and they'll totally eat it. And so afterwards, everything, you know, everything was eaten and it was great. And she asked like the guys in the band, oh, did you enjoy this kind of beef very much? And they're like, oh yeah, we love that. And then she gleefully said, this is cow tongue. This was cow tongue. And then all the guys are like, nope, no, I didn't eat that one. Didn't eat that one. It's like, well, it's all gone. You know, I mean, I know I didn't eat all. I definitely ate some, but I didn't eat everything, you know.
That's funny. I didn't have to go all the way to Japan to have cow tongue. My mom actually made cow tongue like fairly regular. I mean, not regular, but I mean, I had it a number of times, and the way she would prepare it, I don't know how they prepare it in Japan, but it was just the cow's tongue on a plate. And it was, there'd be no confusing it with another, you know, section of meat.
Well, that was because she'd cut it up, right, into smaller pieces.
Like, yeah. The whole tongue on the plate, you know, and then put it at the table. And it's just like, and it had like, it still had the membrane on it, you know, like the taste buds or whatever.
So you mentioned your mom from Texas, so she knew what to do with every piece of that cow.
Apparently, right.
Well, what we did, this is my advice for going through Spain, is you mentioned the promoter taken for tapas. So that was always the pain in the ass, was that the restaurants don't open until like 9, and then we would have to play like at 10, right? And or 10:30. And they wanted to take us to show us whatever the regional delicacies were, which we wanted. But then it was like, eat as fast as you could. And then you had to get up on stage, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we were like, well, we got to turn this around. So a tapas thing is fine in the evening, but we want to have a nice meal the next day at lunch. And so we, most of the time we've been able to work that out where, you know, there'd be a driver and we'd hit some place for a proper lunch. And then we would pour ourselves back into the van and take the siesta as they're driving us to the next town. So I highly recommend that.
Yeah, definitely.
If you can work it off. The other track I want us to take a listen to off the album is Ways. And what I couldn't figure out, I wanted to ask, there seems like there's some type of acoustic instrument in there being plucked on the track, like, I don't know, a mandolin. What is that? There's some other stringed instrument on there?
In 100 Ways?
Yeah.
There's actually, it's just acoustic guitar, and the acoustic guitar is me basically doubling the part I play on electric guitar. So they're both kind of plucking that little melody during the verses, but there's no mandolin or anything, but I can see why it would kind of sound that way. Yeah,
I wasn't sure what it was. And let me double check here. So the track is Ways, or did you say 100 Ways?
100 Ways, yeah.
100 Ways, okay. Well, let me restate then. The other track I want us to take a listen to off the album is 100 Ways. And another thing I love about it is the doo-doo-doo backing vocals. I can't approximate those, right? Whose idea was it to have that backing vocal?
I think that was my idea. Bob and I sang that part in the studio. Bob actually helped me. The first session, Bob was great, and he stuck around for the whole, you know, the whole session and had a lot of input and helped out on backup vocals and everything. So it was fun.
Well, I love the that guitar line. I guess it's him doing it. It comes in at the top of the song, and it kind of comes back in later on. Is that a classic Stinsonism?
I guess you could say that. Yeah. That was just, it's kind of a country and western Stinsonism.
Yeah, yeah, very, very cool. So, what was the story on that one? Was that one that you had already had before by the time when he joined the band, or is it, did that kind of develop while he was in the band?
That was written while he was in the band. And so I you know, and that was that's a great example of where I kind of came up with that the rhythm part, you know, that intro, and then he kind of answered that with that little line he plays, which the two kind of, you know, really go hand in hand together for sure.
Absolutely. Well, Mike, I want to thank you again for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
All right. It's been a pleasure.
We're going to take a listen now to the other track off Riches to Rags. It's the Bleeding Hearts with 100 Ways and Little Steven's Underground Garage. just heard a bit of the track 100 Ways off the Bleeding Hearts album Riches to Rags. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's Mike Leonard for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. The California band Nerf Herder, they've been around since the 1990s and always a champion of fun, nerdy things. Their latest single, Born Weird, even includes contributions from Weird Al Yankovic and Dr. Demento. We're going to find out all about it on your next Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. They say that love is blind.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.